If there's one foundational characteristic of the humanities, it must be dictionary work. Since I will be discussing the category of the moral sciences, which is a rather alien and archaic term, I will be doing some dictionary work on your behalf. And since our conference is concerned with the changing humanities, I will try and ascertain, using the dictionary and other scholarship, which senses the humanities has, and where those senses have come from. First thing to note about the humanities is that it's always plural. Humanity means something completely different from humanities. The obvious source for this peculiarity is dual. First, translation from the 18th century French, les humanités, and second, as a shortened and anglicized form of literae humaniores, implicitly, humanities is an adjectival form qualifying literae, lettres, or letters. The humanities are always concerned with letters, with words, with texts. However, the exponents of the humanities often are not content just to be concerned with letters. Hence the intense ambivalence about the virtues of philology as the foundation of the humanities, including ambivalence over dictionary work. Beyond the letter is the spirit, as if St. Paul's words continue to resonate. The letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life. Despite being committed to the study of the dead letter, the humanities continue to dream of giving life. Beyond the humanities lies humanity itself. Like the OED itself, Fowler's marvellous modern English usage is full of eccentricities and moments when the careful scholar goes on holiday. In 1926, Fowler gave, as his sole definition of the humanities, let's see if this works, an old-fashioned name for the study of classical literature, see humanist. When we turn to humanist, Fowler gives four senses, which I'm not giving verbatim, the name for Renaissance scholars who revived the study of pre-Christian literature, free thinkers or skeptics, or something of that sort, positivists, which makes sense to Fowler, since Comte was the founder of the religion of humanity. And then fourth, we have the reader, occasionally realizes that his writer is using the word in the sense in which he might have invented it for himself, one for whom the proper study of mankind is man, the student, and especially the kindly or humane student of human nature. What Fowler doesn't offer is a sense of humanities as the study of something larger than classical literature, although he does offer the somewhat far-fetched claim that a humanist is precisely a person who is humane and therefore studies human nature. Or is it the other way round? Does he become humane through studying human nature? Having come this far, it's time to turn to the OED, which offers two senses of the humanities. The first we are now familiar with, classical learning. Here is the second. Is that right? Yes. That can't be right. The branch of, that's the first, and this is the second. The branch of learning concerned with human culture. The academic subjects collectively comprising this branch of learning as history, literature, ancient and modern languages, law, philosophy, art, and music. Maybe the dictionary editors felt they had taken a step too far by defining the humanities as the study of human culture. So they venture the following tendentious clarification. You know those bits in the new OED which kind of are indented and in slightly smaller print, and the editors let fly at that point. So what they say is, the humanities are typically distinguished from the social sciences in having a significant historical element, in the use of interpretation of texts and artifacts rather than experimental and quantitative methods, and in having an ideographic rather than nomothetic character. The most striking feature of the OED's attempt to construct a tenable definition of humanities is the distinction between the ideographic, the singular, the event, and the nomothetic, the law-like, the generalizable, a distinction first introduced by Windelbrandt in 1894 in his lecture on history and the natural sciences. So what's going on? What got to the OED? Having clearly overreached themselves with their self-serving definition, the dictionary editors immediately realized that there are other disciplines concerned with human culture, notably the social sciences or the human sciences. And my talk today is concerned with the strange history of one of those disciplines that competes and overlaps with the literary humanities, the moral sciences. One of the morals of my talk today, I now discover, is to read the dictionary with a certain amount of skepticism. So let's get the worst and the best over with here. Here is the OED's definition of moral sciences. Those branches of knowledge which deal with the criteria of right and wrong. And then we get the interesting bit, Cambridge University. Politics, philosophy, and economics as a course of study. The first definition is palpably incorrect. I don't know what planet they were on when they wrote that. The second is a philological joke at Cambridge's expense. It's not for nothing that it's called the Oxford English Dictionary. From now on, I will try to explore the source of this joke and what it tells us about the development of the humanities, the social sciences, the human sciences, and the moral sciences in this university in the last 200 years, since 1809. AD, one might say, after Darwin. As Simon Goldhill and Alice Jenkins have reminded us, the early 18th and 19th century notions of a liberal education in Cambridge was founded on classics and mathematics. To stave off the growing criticism of Cambridge and provide some response to the educational innovations of the University of London and the Scottish universities, the natural sciences and moral sciences tripos were introduced in 1850. The contemporaneous Graham Commission, fruit of parliamentary and even royal agitation to produce reform in Cambridge of the late 1840s, did recommend additional new triposes beyond classics and mathematics and the new natural and moral sciences. They recommended modern languages, law, engineering, and theology, which eventually were created. Before the humanities emerged, the moral sciences were installed as the appropriate counterpart to the natural sciences. Now, in contemporary English, the term moral has been completely overwhelmed by the sense of goodness and rightness. However, in the 18th century, moral also connoted the domain of the practical, of what was appropriate for living. Moral certainty in the 18th century was the degree of certainty required for practical life, in contrast with mathematical certainty. The tone is captured by Buffon's measure of moral certainty. All fear or hope, whose probability equals that which produces the fear of death, in the moral realm may be taken as unity against which all other fears are to be measured. So, the mortality tables show that the chance of my dying in the next 24 hours is 0.0001. Because I do not take account of this chance, we can take this chance as morally zero and deploy it as our baseline of moral certainty. That's the dimension of the moral in one of its senses, but an important one in the 18th and early 19th century. Now, the best known of the 19th century expositions of the field of the moral sciences was the final section of John Stuart Mill's Logic of 1843. For Mill, the moral sciences were part of the sciences of nature. They studied human nature. And his entire preoccupation was with showing the similarities and differences between these and other inductive and deductive sciences. The span of the moral sciences ran from the laws of the mind to psychology to ethology, which was his term for the science of character, to political economy, to politics, and on to Kantian visions of a science of society with its three historical laws. Not that Mill was optimistic about the chances of this moral science, because of the complexity of the phenomena and the impossibility of conducting experiments to test putative laws. The example he gives of such a law is the universally beneficial effects of restriction of trade. This is 1843, remember? But he argued that there were no, in principle, objections to the development of such a moral science. So, when the Moral Sciences Tripos was established in 1850, the subjects it covered were moral philosophy, modern history, political economy, jurisprudence, and the laws of England, a list mainly derived from the already existing professorships. However, its fissile and unstable character was immediately evident. Law, which was subject in those years to extreme forces stemming from crises in professional legal education in England, quickly formed its own tripos in 1854, centred on Roman law as what Maine called the grammar of all advanced legal systems. In 1868, history was forcefully rejected from the moral sciences tripos and temporarily rejoined law, only to form its own tripos in 1875. None of these new triposes up to this point had proved particularly popular with students. But in the 1870s, numbers began to pick up as measures protective of the traditional subjects of classics and mathematics were eased. And it should always be borne in mind that these reforms were obeying at least two independent imperatives. Firstly, reforming the education of undergraduates, and secondly, introducing the German ideal of research into the university, most visibly in the new museums, the heart of these Germanic research programs for many disciplines in the mid-19th century. So you get the Fitzwilliam, the new museum site for zoology and anatomy, the Downing site for petrology, geology, archaeology, and eventually anthropology. The laboratories, which became the hallmark teaching and research institutions of the sciences and medicine, came a little later. The clearest index of the German research imperative driving innovation in the university came with the introduction of triposes for non-classical languages. First off, Semitic languages in 1878, followed in 1879 by Indian languages, based, of course, on Sanskrit. Then, in 1886, came a further philological initiative, medieval and modern languages, in which, presaging Sarah Kay's trajectory, of which we will hear more tomorrow, French, Provençal, and Italian were taught together. Numbers of students taking the new triposes did begin to pick up in the 1880s, and a key factor in their expansion was the women students. Often half of the candidates were women who were also very successful at securing firsts, whether in moral sciences or languages. However, moral sciences failed to expand, although two of its most distinguished exponents, Henry Sidgwick from classics and Alfred Marshall from mathematics, gave it its intellectual direction for the final third of the 19th century, and it did produce fine students. For example, Frederick Maitland, the great legal historian, James Ward, later professor of philosophy and founder of Cambridge Psychology, and the future Prime Minister, Arthur Balfour. But a crucial loss of coherence for the moral sciences tripos had already taken place with the loss of history. The fatal blow was to follow in 1905 with the departure of economics to form its own tripos. Before then, in 1902-4, the future anthropologist Radcliffe Brown took the mental and moral sciences science tripos, it was called that temporarily for a few years, and this at that time covered psychology, logic, political economy, politics, and ethics. From 1905 on, with law, history, and economics departed, moral sciences was restricted to philosophy together with the beginnings of a thriving psychology research school under C.S. Myers and W.H.R. Rivers. Equally importantly, when Haddon and Myers pieced together a course of study in anthropology, they didn't bring anthropology within the moral sciences tripos. In retrospect, we might ask, what could have been more in keeping with the original conception of a science of man underlying the idea of a moral science than anthropology? Indeed, the first holder of a lectureship in social anthropology at the University of Cambridge, W.E. Armstrong, had specialized in psychology in the moral sciences tripos in 1918. He'd done fieldwork in Papua New Guinea and then been an anthropology lecturer in Cambridge before migrating in the 1930s to become lecturer in economics at Southampton. That's a very moral sciences trajectory. However, anthropology had already established its own diploma in 1908 and then its own tripos just before the Great War. Now, before looking in more detail at the ethos of the MST and its effects, I want to introduce a red herring. We saw how the OED called upon a German philosopher of the 1890s, Windelbrandt, to endorse its definition of the humanities. Many others have groped for some serious-sounding German philosophical distinction with which to create space for obscure motives between the natural sciences and their other. The most frequently called upon such distinction is Diltai's distinction between the Geisteswissenschaften and the Naturwissenschaften. The fact that this term, Geisteswissenschaften, is usually left untranslated and so is familiar to monolingual English speakers indicates already the hornet's nest involved in its translation. Even Diltai complained about the indefiniteness of Geist, but he decided that the alternatives that he considered, and this is his list, Gesellschaftswissenschaften, Wissenschaft, Sozialwissenschaft, Moralische, or Geschichtliche, or Kulturwissenschaften, these were all equally unsatisfactory. So it's not just a problem restricted to English. The real problem is choosing the target English term. The Germans think Geisteswissenschaften should be translated as the humanities, not least because this would now allow for the neat division of Geisteswissenschaften, Sozialwissenschaften, and Naturwissenschaften corresponding to humanities, social sciences, and natural sciences. But Geisteswissenschaft in part owes its prominence in German philosophy to the fact that it was used to translate Mill's Logic of the Moral Sciences in, depending on, this is a disputed philological question, whether it's 1848 or 1861. Does this mean that when English-speaking philosophers draw upon the apparatus that comes with the Geisteswissenschaften, they're working with a background set of assumptions imported willy-nilly from the English moral sciences? And what if we complicate matters by introducing the les sciences morales et politiques of the Napoleonic academic institutions? No, I don't think we inhabit it without knowing it, the iron cage of terminologies and their assumptions that are shuffled around in various European languages. But we are sometimes led astray if we do not know the genealogy of our terms. So, end of red herring. When new disciplines or groupings of disciplines come into being, they are often responses to contingent moments, sometimes to one-off opportunities. Yet there was one historical force which would have enormous effects in Cambridge. Money. Principles crumble, sometimes surprisingly fast, when faced with financial pressures and lures. Cambridge had long held out against offering practical education, but when in 1890 the government, that's the British government, offered funding through the county councils for agricultural education, the university accepted quickly. Money was already in short supply. And there were two professorships that came at the end of the 1890s. Just in case, to dispel some prejudice perhaps about the nature of disciplines, there's a direct line that goes from agriculture to the Department of Pure Maths and Applied Maths and Statistics, a very famous department. And this line goes via agriculture to genetics, to statistics, and then to all the statistical sciences that we have today. There are many interesting lines that go across the departments, faculties, schools, clearly, but agriculture is one of those. So Cambridge's strength in the biological and mathematical sciences in the 20th century is in part owed to the government saying, County Council will give you grants for students to study agriculture. So back to my paper. But so, similarly, the setting up in the 1890s of the mechanical sciences tripos, later to become engineering and the largest faculty in the university, was resisted by those who deplored any practical element in Cambridge education. Here again, external funding played an important role. And 20 years after, just prior to the Great War, the government's Medical Research Committee, later Council, proposed to give Cambridge a grant. Again, against considerable opposition, now invoking the principle that the university should not receive any government funding, the proposal was approved. And following the war, the university, on the verge of bankruptcy, sought again medical and more general funding, and this became a permanent system of grants for the broader sweep of the sciences. But the price for that was the general reform of the Oxford and Cambridge Act of 1926, which introduced, amongst other things, the faculty and departmental system, a salary structure, a permanent establishment of lecturers attached to each faculty, that explicitly meritocratic system of publicly limited grants for less well-off students, that system which has died within living memory, and a general board statutorily divided between the sciences and the arts, as the government and the university called them. Arts, that is. It's this general reform that then led to disciplinary retrenchment, to a closing down of innovation. And the moral sciences would now be frozen in time until the late 1960s, when the university would finally accept the idea of the social sciences in place of the moral sciences and introduce a social and political sciences committee and change the name of the moral sciences faculty to that of philosophy. Now, to evoke another factor, that of historical contingency, we should look briefly at the moment of the creation of the English tripos. The opportunity for a successful secession from medieval and modern languages arose under wartime conditions. Not only was Cambridge nearly empty of students, but the forces within MML who vigorously opposed the study of modern literature, the brothers-in-law E.G.W. Braunholz, a Romance philologist who produced editions of Racine, Corneille, and Molière, and Karl Breul, editor of the Cassell's German-English Dictionary, these two men were both German, and their views were effectively screened out by the chauvinist atmosphere induced by the ongoing war. So in 1917, the English tripos was speedily whisked through the university. In this course, according to Basil Willey, a mid-20th century historian of ideas, in the English faculty writing his memoirs in 1968, quote, students and lovers of our literature could pursue their chosen subject without having to endure the alien yoke of Teutonic philology. The frisson of xenophobia could serve a useful discipline-building function, placing distance between the rigors and scientific pretensions of the German research program and the new implicitly nationalistic dawn of English literature that would be best captured by the parochial self-importance of Willy's colleague, F.R. Leavis. Rivalry with the German academic machine would take many forms around the Great War. One of the, its more unlikely but important effects was to introduce the PhD degree to Cambridge in 1919, expressly to attract American researchers away from German universities. No Cambridge man was initially expected to complete such a degree, but it was crucial for Britain to win the academic peace as well as the cultural war. Between the victory over Teutonic philology in the era of Dr. Leavis, the English tripos would find another charismatic intellectual innovator, I.A. Richards. Richards graduated in the moral sciences tripos in 1915. Enthused by Freud, he planned to become a psychoanalyst and started preclinical studies in the Cavendish Laboratory in 1917, only to lose heart very quickly. In 1919, he was persuaded to lecture for the new English tripos, and he would go on to provide both inspirational method and justificatory theory for the new discipline. His story is a crucial link between the moral sciences and a discipline right at the heart of the modern humanities. However, in the brief time I have, I can only address two themes in Richards's most original and influential text, Practical Criticism of 1929. The first point is to make is that the word practical in its title is explicitly meant to evoke the scientific practical. Richards, who'd done scientific practicals in the moral sciences courses devoted to psychology, had invented an experimental method for the study of literature, and this book was a guide to the conducting of such practicals. His method was the following. In the first lecture of his course, he issued printed sheets to those attending, of poems supplying the bare text with no authorial attribution or date of composition. He asked his audience to comment freely in writing on these poems. He then collected their comments, suitably anonymized, in the second lecture. And in the third and subsequent lectures, he commented on their comments. The aim was not to teach students anything directly about the poems themselves, but rather to elucidate their responses and judgments, often multiple responses from multiple readings, each reading treated as a separate quasi-experimental session. Richards clearly relished his introduction of such laboratory methods to the brand new English Tripos in the period 1926, when the preeminence of the sciences in the university was being written into the new statutes and ordinances. So he called these comments protocols, and the experimental subjects were called protocol writers. Richards imported laboratory methods knowingly. Equally knowingly, he presented his lecture room technique as using the methods of the psychological clinic, which he called the only good legacy left by the war. And he used these methods to diagnose and treat the pathologies of reading, which his method uncovered. As explicitly akin to psychoanalysis, it is easy to see how Richard's method was an extension of Freud's psychopathology of everyday life. It was a psychopathology of everyday reading. The experiment was designed to induce errors, provoke mistakes, force the reader to reveal the vice of his or her reading, his obstinacy and conceit, his stock responses, a famous phrase that became a trademark of this tradition, experimental tradition. Now, Richard's enthusiasm for psychology was typical of English intellectual life and Cambridge in particular at this time after the Great War, although he was judiciously eclectic in seeking it from behaviorism, from Sherrington's nerve impulse theories, and from psychoanalysis as the occasion demanded. But if psychology was the driving theory, the aims were the classical goals of the moral sciences. The methods I have here tried to apply to critical questions have to be applied to questions of morals, political theory, logic, economics, metaphysics, religion, and psychology. He was not staking out new ground for a new discipline, but returning to the original broad conception of the moral sciences. But then, as Stefan Collini has pointed out, Richard's work became the vehicle for the distinctive Cambridge approach to literature, a vigilant and exclusive close verbal criticism then applied to recent and contemporary literature, e.g. T.S. Eliot, leading to the conviction, so fateful to its ideological future, that literary criticism involves one's whole being and is thus an exemplary moral activity. This shift from Mill's sense of moral science to Leavis's occupation of the moral high ground was achieved unintentionally by the experimental method Richards introduced in the hope of fulfilling the aims of the tradition of Cambridge moral science. Sometime between the 1920s and the 1950s, the word moral lost all its other connotations and became the province of the high-minded and those committed to value judgments as the core of the humanities. Now, I'm running out of time. I do want to make two further comments. Richard's psychoanalytic orientation could be renamed a reflexive term. The aim of the laboratory practicals is the uncovering of stock responses, of unreflected upon forces and dispositions that disturb reading practices. This is how Freud affected his readers. They turned first to the interpretation of their own dreams, their own slips, their own complexes. Richards's methods could lead those first students of the English Tripos not to philological inquiries concerning sources and texts, but to psychological inquiries concerning their own prejudices and stock responses. At the very least, the philological and the psychological would be dual paths of learning. This reflexivity was not restricted to New English. The distinctive method of participant observation promoted in parallel to Richards in the 1920s, first by W.H.R. Rivers, then by Malinowski and others, has a significant methodological source in Freudian reflexivity. A key example, which I don't have time to go into, would be John Layard, who went on from MML to fieldwork in the South Pacific with Rivers, the English Freud, and returned from his fieldwork in a state of nervous collapse to be given psychological treatment by Rivers while he was treating his more famous patient, Siegfried Sassoon. The echoes of this historical episode and of Layard's remarkable long life up to the end of the 1960s as anthropologist and psychoanalyst — this is a man who first psychoanalyst with W.H.R. Rivers and his last psychoanalyst was R.D. Lang — this has an echo in the fact that that there is a figure in contemporary British life, Lord Richard Layard, who is Layard's son and who is the happiness czar in the Labour government at the moment. And there's also room for comparison with the reflexivity characteristic of Diltai's Verstehen methodology, appropriate for part, let's say, for part of the Geisteswissenschaften. Now, I've run out of time. I wanted to talk very briefly about two other exemplary Cambridge moral scientists, one of them John Maynard Keynes, the other Frank Ramsey, but I think I should draw my comments to a close. So let's return to the OED. Remember the second definition of the moral sciences. Where we go back. Cambridge University. Cambridge University. Politics, philosophy, economics as a course of study. This is an Oxford joke at the expense of Cambridge. One of the most successful courses of undergraduate instruction in the 20th century was introduced in 1920 by Oxford as philosophy, politics, and economics, PPE. 1920 was just when the project of the moral sciences was beginning to collapse in Cambridge. Psychology deserted for the safer haven of the natural sciences, organizationally speaking, in the 1920s. It's a long, complicated story, but not irrelevant, but I can't talk about it now. Oxford went on to add insult to injury in 1946 by introducing PPP, philosophy, psychology, and physiology. In this fashion, Oxford built up by far the largest school of philosophy in Britain. Despite what the OED says, Cambridge never had PPE. Instead, it had the moral sciences, a far grander Victorian project in the human sciences, which was a seedbed for diverse parts of the humanities in ways which have since been obscured, not least, we now know, by the philological failings, the stock responses of the dictionary. Thank you.